Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 3rd, 2017, and welcome to episode 158 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find
the RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, reunions, apocalypses, and so forth. So, hello everybody. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am your host today for RCR 158. And joining me also from Boston, we have Ken Gagne. How are you, Ken?
Hey, Paul, long time no chat. Glad to be back.
Yes. Are you enjoying the rain?
Well, you know, it is Labor Day weekend. I have taken some days off to make it a 5-day weekend. So if one of them wants to be rainy, that's fine. I'll get my cycling in some other day.
Okay. Sounds good. So good to have you back. And joining us now from a long hiatus is Dr. Steve Wyrick. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm doing fine.
In Omaha, I should.
In Omaha, and in Omaha, we have nice sunny weather, and it's a wonderful late summer day.
Nice. Yeah, it's actually starting to get slightly cooler here. Working further west, going in order of the little bubbles in my Skype window, Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, Paul. And also, I'm going to comment on the weather as well, because we are still in the middle of a crazy heat wave that just seems to be unrelenting. And I think the temperature is going to be 100 degrees again today. Ouch. And it's just crazy. I mean, it gets hot in Portland during the summer, but not usually this hot, not usually for this long. So there you go. Mm-hmm. I do have friends in Houston who have been through all the craziness that's going on down there. So I suppose me complaining about the heat is a bit misguided, but it's still hot though. So I'm just going to go on record with that.
Yeah, I have definitely seen the people in LA, you know, on the Twitter stream, unhappy with how hot it is even further south of you. But
yes, yeah, they've been having unseasonably hot weather also. That's true.
And it did occur to me as I complained about the rain that I have nothing to complain about. But sorry, Houston, good luck.
Yes, indeed.
And the last Skype bubble here is Jack Nutting in Sweden. How are you?
Hey, Paul, I'm doing pretty good. I guess I can also add my 2 cents about the weather here. Sweden weather, it's kind of in between. Yeah, it's okay. We had a little bit of rain, a little bit of sunshine, not very warm. So I've been living like vicariously through my family, some of who are in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So they have all the weather for me. And they're fortunate that they're fine. I'm fortunate that also they're fine. So no one's houses are flooded or anything.
That's good.
They're terribly inconvenienced like everyone else, but that's it could have been much, much worse.
Yeah. All right. Well, this wasn't actually supposed to be synergistic in any way, but I'm responsible for the host topic today, and I have lifted something that was suggested by someone who wrote in, Andy, who wrote in to suggest a topic which he called the Retropocalypse. And his idea, the question basically was, what kind of thing might drive computing to go back offline? And you know, the title Retropocalypse kind of suggests a massive infrastructure disaster that dissipates the cloud and brushes away the web and forces us, you know, back to the whatever transistor age. But There are also sort of privacy and security advantages of these old, limited, isolated machines. And so he wondered if there was a difference between just being retro and being obsolete. Like, are there still sort of things that are positives about the old computers and might, even if not infrastructural disasters, but like data privacy disasters, lead to new uses of older tech? Thought it was interesting. I don't really know for sure what to say about this, but it's an interesting idea, you know, the continuing idea that maybe our old computers are still good for something. Maybe they did something better than things do now. So I don't know if anyone wanted to lead off with any thoughts on that.
I suppose it really comes down to what is it that you need to do with your computing device that is network essential. I mean, when I had just my old 8-bit Apple II, it was stuff I could do locally, like writing my own programs, typing in things from a magazine. But what really opened up the world for me was being able to do something on a modem, which is not exactly local only. That's online instead of offline. So I don't know what I would use my computer for if I, other than just, say, storing a diary or taking care of photos and things like that. I'm not sure what I'd be using a computer for if I didn't have network available, if I was stuck in a prolonged power outage, as those some of those people in Houston are. I would probably not be worrying so much about what am I doing with my computer.
Yeah, it's it's interesting how hard it is to even conceive of not connected computers now. It's just so fundamental in how we use them. But in the 80s, 8-bit days, there were these like small pipe connections, you know, over the phone line and that sort of thing. Maybe we could grant ourselves those. It's a little more difficult to kind of like take over people's computers over those small pipes, for example.
Definitely.
If it's a security concern.
Although there were a few viruses you could get, not too many, but there was a few you could get, but it wasn't on the radar that much at that time.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting question because we've sometimes cover systems that are old, obsolete seeming systems that are still in use today just because of accident or inertia. Like there was a thing with, I forget, this old company, it's a company that makes some kind of, I don't know what they make, some kind of physical hardware of some kind, and their software is essentially these giant circuit boards that they plug in and out of something to do their bookkeeping and accounting and stuff, something from the 50s. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to change it because, like, that's not their business. Their business is not about software. Their business is about making whatever they're making, and they don't want to spend whatever it would take to buy the software to replace that thing that's worked for decades. And there was a thing with some school district somewhere whose heating systems were managed by an Amiga standing in somebody's office and had been, you know, doing that for 30 years and just, you know, buying replacement parts they need to off eBay. And they didn't either want to change it because, like, their best estimate of what it was going to cost to build a new system like that from scratch with some consultants was going to be like $1 million or whatever. And it made no sense. But I haven't seen many stories of where someone intentionally goes back to something older and simpler. I guess because like the idea of building something new for an old computer to do is not going to be any easier or cheaper than building it for a new computer to do. Like if I'm going to build a new accounting system, you know, from scratch, it's going to be no cheaper or easier to build that for an Apple II than for a modern PC, right? Because I don't have the tools, I don't have the storage capacity, all that stuff. So, but I mean, I guess it's hard to sort of imagine. Like I said, it's harder to even remember the pre-internet days. I kind of remember, but it's hard to even think of it now. So it's hard to think of examples of where would I, how could I make this easier and simpler and dumber, and but still be able to do it in a reasonable amount of time and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. There's so many things I do simultaneously with my current modern computer, having email open and a web browser open, music and photos and all this other stuff that I have kind of open at the same time, and I can because it works. But to stop and change and switch disks and go do this, I mean, we do that a lot now just because it's so simple and it's intended to be interconnected, that there's some things I would probably just set aside if I didn't have that available. Wait until I had my network back.
Right. What do you think, Earl?
Well, I think that if you're concerned about being hacked, certainly you're not going to be hacked if you're running a Commodore 64 or an Apple II, because there's just no way to hack it. On the other hand, I'm kind of going with the rest of the crowd here and thinking, what do I want to do that I can do offline? And it's just not that compelling for me to even worry about it. So it's true that I won't be hacked. But on the other hand, the safest computer is buried in 3 feet of concrete. It's also the least useful computer. Mm-hmm. And so while I love my retro computers and love to work with them for purposes that aren't practical, I don't think in the apocalypse that I would turn to them for purposes that are practical. I used them for that stuff back in the day, but I just don't know what I would do today with it.
Mm-hmm.
One advantage that I will say that it does have, and we've talked about this before in terms of, you know, we like retro now and we like to grab our old retro stuff and play with it. Right now, my son is playing a first-person shooter game that takes a server to operate. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's one of these typical things that you get on a server and you're playing with other people. And in the future, how are they going to have retro? Because nobody's going to stand up a server for every single one of those games just so that they can relive some old memories. So,
by themselves.
By themselves, right. The one thing that the retro computers do have going for them is that you turn them on and pretty much they're ready to go. And unlike a Chromebook or a network-based first-person shooter or any of these things, they don't need a web infrastructure to be out there to operate. I suppose in that sense, you know, they would have the advantage when the big one hits, whatever the big one we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Ken?
I'm reminded of the end of Terminator 3, where Skynet, which in this version of the Terminator franchise is software-based, essentially like a virus. It infiltrates all the world's networks and takes down basically all of human civilization. John Connor is safe and protected inside a NORAD mountain facility, for example. And if you pause the movie, you can see that this facility is stocked with some ancient technology. I can't name specific brands or models, but it's like 1970s era computers. And these are the computers that are safe from Skynet. This is what he uses to rebuild humanity and wage the war against the machines. I don't think we'll ever be in a situation that dire. God, I hope not, even though this past week was the 20th anniversary of Judgment Day. But there may be some use, some facility for Apple II, Commodore 64, Amiga, TRS-80, should civilization collapse. But I think they will not be what we revert to. I think they will be a intermediary or an interstitial technology until we rebuild what we have. I think it's in humanity's nature to try to reclaim what we lost. And so if our network goes down, we'll try to bring it back up, as opposed to saying, oh, we should learn from this and rely on Apple II computers.
Right.
Which we will no longer be able to build.
Right, but that's a really interesting point, though. Once we have it, we don't want to not have it anymore. So we would immediately try to figure out how to get back to where we were, albeit in hopefully a safer manner.
One would think.
I mean, one of the things that occurs to me a bit in this sort of like apocalypse scenario is just the fact that I might, if my Apple II breaks, I might be able to get it going again. If my, you know, MacBook breaks, it's done. Like, there's nothing I can do to make this work again. So that, you know, the older technology is bigger and simpler and more repairable, possibly more sustainable, possibly made in a way that is less subject to just deterioration. You know, like the new computers are a lot more disposable than the old ones were, at least at a certain period. So there is that also, that possibly the only people who are able to rebuild when all the electronics factories have disintegrated are only able to rebuild this sort of like 70s, 80s tech.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you think about entertainment too. Records, vinyl records, and even cylinders, older stuff, is very durable for the most part. That stuff can play. I mean, heck, they use just a plain old needle stuck to something that vibrates, something that will show, that'll make sound through the cone in a wind up turntable. Those things still work today, and it's very simple technology. That would be something you could use even if you have no access to MP3s or CDs that work.
Right, right. If everything gets demagnetized, you know.
Exactly.
Whatever game was shipped on the flexi disc in the magazine, that'll still work.
That's right.
And paper tapes.
Well, yeah, likewise, if a worldwide digital network gets taken down, we've still got shortwave communications that we can use. So, and, you know, the tube rigs from those days are a lot less likely to get fried in an EMP, I guess, is also true. So, I don't know, maybe. It's going to have to get pretty bad, is I think what we're coming down to here.
Right.
It won't just be like your garden variety apocalypse. This has got to be like a really bad apocalypse. You know, like probably a 9 on the apocalypse Richter scale before we revert.
It's quite possible that there will be more important things than like playing Brick Out.
Never.
Well, okay, so I guess we've mapped out the future apocalypse now really well. We know what to expect. So thanks, Andy, for the topic idea. Okay, let's see. So I'll turn now to listener feedback. I'll quickly say a couple of things. So one is that Sebastian wrote in about the Amiga, and I was wondering, Jack, if I could pawn that off to you, because you actually responded a little bit to that. Did you want to say anything about his email?
Yes, it was very interesting. So Sebastian wrote in, and I've forgotten all the salient details, but he said that basically the fact of the existence of the modern Amiga computers is largely thanks to the investment of one guy whose name I don't remember. Basically, somebody who is independently wealthy, I guess, who loved the Amiga and wanted it to have some sort of future and invested in creating this new platform. And he also mentioned that the computer that I talked about, which was pretty expensive, I think the whole computer was about $1,700, or was that pounds or euros? I don't know. But he said that was actually a much more expensive model. There's another model that's available or will be soon, for which the main board is about a third of the price. Mm-hmm. So there will be much cheaper options, basically. And he said, kind of reiterated what we said, that most of the enthusiast community who are interested in this are not looking at this so much as here's a brand new Amiga that can do everything you could do on a brand new Mac or PC, but that it's a great way to run old software, much easier than actually starting up emulators and stuff, because it essentially has a built-in emulator for all the old Amiga stuff. So anyway, it's pretty interesting. There's a lot.
And a fun way to live in an alternate universe.
Yes.
Well, yeah, it's a fun story to hear, you know, that the idea of getting fabulously wealthy and then using and pouring that into something like the Amiga. I would
right.
love to do that.
Yep. So let's try and we'll link to something useful about this in the show notes.
Okay. Excellent. Let's see. So the next thing I wanted to mention is that Todd wrote in to say that the Captain's Quarters BBS is back online. He said this was a BBS AE line, so what is that, ASCII Express line, in northern Minnesota in the mid-1980s, and he's now got it running on a 2GS via a Raspberry Pi with TCP SYR. And he gave us a couple of links to the Wi-Fi 232 that we talked about before, which is a modem emulator that operates over Wi-Fi, and a link to SyncTerm, which is a terminal program you can use to log in. So that's pretty cool. I signed in and tried it out a little bit. And actually, one of the things, it's a mildly interesting story, I suppose, that one of the things he was looking for was a copy of the old BBS software that he used to run. He didn't have it anymore. He remembered it was called Nexus. And it doesn't really seem to have much representation on the internet. There was a mention on, I think, Jason Scott's website somewhere that said, like, you know, there's somebody referred to this once in Usenet asking if they could find it, but that was about it. Turned out I have one, a copy of this on a disc from, you know, 1986 or something. And I don't know what I was doing with it. I was collecting BBS software or something at the time. But so I made an image of it and sent him that, and actually also tracked down the person who wrote it. And that was kind of fun. This was all like middle of the night last night that I was doing this. So I emailed this guy who's, you know, gone off to do something entirely different. And he was blown away by seeing this program that, you know, he'd last seen when he was 13 or something. Cause he'd basically left programming after junior high when he had written this thing and distributed it around. But so that was pretty cool. It doesn't look like we have any new leads at the moment toward, functioning copies of the software. The one that I have has been tinkered with a little bit because, you know, I was a kid. But anyway, that was kind of neat. So thanks, Todd, for writing that led me down this kind of interesting path.
One thing I want to say about the Captain's Quarters BBS, if I understand correctly, this BBS is running Warp 6 software, which is what was detailed in the June issue of Juice GS. Mike Whalen and Scott Johnson collaborated to get Warp 6 running over the internet, and Todd used that article to get his BBS up and running, and he even got a copy of a door game I had written for Warp 6 20 years ago, and he got that up and running too. So he emailed me to say, hey, Ken, if you want to play your own game that you probably haven't seen in 25 years, I'm running it.
That's really cool. What is the game?
It's called Spaceship of Death.
Evocative.
That's perfect. Not ominous or anything.
Now, on one hand, it totally sounds like a name I would have come up with when I was 15 years old. On the other hand, I didn't come up with it. It is actually an Apple II port of an Atari ST door game. I got the original author's permission. He didn't give me any source code. I just played the game a lot and then wrote an Apple II version that looked and acted the same.
Huh. Cool.
Yeah.
That's fun.
So, okay, let's see. The last bit of feedback I will mention is that Andy wrote in with a thought about modern common API calls in games. What I think he was thinking about was, you know, current modern game development houses interfacing with graphic subsystems and things like that in a kind of a black box way, so that it's fairly easy to just move the core game from platform to platform. And what he wonders is what it would have been like if this had been more common in the 8-bit era. Wonders if people would have used Quantum Link on their Atari STs or GEOS on the Apples II. Because BASIC wasn't all that universal. There was always, you know, some little differences between the varieties, even if they were all Microsoft on the different machines. I think that's interesting. I would point out that GEOS was on the Apple II. And the Infocom and Scott Adams or Adventure International were pretty well known for actually writing a portable core to their thing. So Infocom just wrote a core program and an interpreter on each language. In fact, Sierra did the same thing too, I think, right?
Well, I think the problem that you'd have with trying to do, I mean, I'm not a programmer. I don't know how much involvement there is as far as space with doing an API, but to create something like that, to say generate reasonably similar graphics on an Atari and a TRS-80 and an Apple II and a Commodore, to try to make something like that, I think would require a layer of programming on top of what you're putting in that machine, which would be great if you had space, but with 48K of RAM on a lot of those, once you took the ROM code out, there probably wasn't a lot of space to do that sort of thing. They had to often just do it on the metal and use the secrets for making Apple II graphics or making Atari graphics or whatever work. You had to use those things in order to get the performance.
And I guess that's probably what, in a sense, made this kind of ideal for the text adventures, because that's the lowest common denominator.
Definitely.
They could all do that.
I do remember, I've heard a number of people being interviewed on the Antic podcast, where they've interviewed programmers who worked on things in the 80s, and many of them worked on titles that were available on the Atari and the Apple II and the Commodore 64, and a lot of them, they seemed to see that, for them, cross-platform meant 6502. Like, it meant that they could write the core of their game engine in 6502 assembly, and that would be the same, you know, from one platform to the other. And then when it came to what the output looked like, what the graphics looked like, they would have to, you know, there would be a whole different subsystem for each one. Right. And, you know, since they all were, had different capabilities, it could never really be quite the same. And just like you said, Steve, like the overhead for trying to make something where you would have a way to represent them all as the same would require some kind of layer in between to map out, okay, here's a generic thing into the specific thing for this platform that there probably just was never really space for.
I mean, in a sense, if you, I know that you had games that came out for several different computers, 8-bit computers in the day, say 6502 ones, probably a lot of the code of those games was identical between the three, you know, three or four platforms, but you'd have to say, okay, so you know how to do a Commodore, you make the graphics on this Commodore port work.
Right.
And you do it for the Atari here and so on. And so in a sense, that's a very primitive type of an API. It's not really, it's, you want to draw a line in a spaceship here. Well, this is how this computer does it. This is how that one does it. So it's a very primitive API, but it wasn't what, it wasn't the kind of sophistication that we have today that he's thinking of.
Right.
And I think, you know, one of the things that makes all this difficult is that these are slow machines. So you know, if you want sort of acceptable non-blinky graphics, you have to use the tricks that are available on the machine. I mean, like, you know, so Atari had some built-in graphics stuff, and with the, you know, Apple II, you had two graphics pages you could flip between, and, you know, it's quite possible that they're, it's almost not comparable. Like, if you want an acceptable-looking game on both platforms, you kind of have to do a lot of tweaking on each one.
Now that I think of it, and Ken, you might remember this better, maybe Paul would also, the game that is being made that they didn't report on this year much at Kansas Fest, the last 2 years they did the old Western game that Martin Hay is helping with and so on. They're making that to run on more than one platform, aren't they?
Lawless Legends? I think so.
Lawless Legends, yes. So they're probably using some of the API technology thought style in doing that so that they don't have to recreate too many things. But again, they're making it so it will really work on the metal. So that's going to be a limitation simply because you have to make it perform.
Yes, that game is coming out simultaneously for Apple II and Commodore 64.
Yes. Big leap between the two graphic capabilities of those two as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks everybody for writing in, and please continue to write in. We will tell you at the end how to do that. But I can tell you right now, it's feedback at rcrpodcast.com. Okay, so we can now move on to items of interest and news. And Jack, you have the first one.
Yeah, this popped up a few weeks ago. I don't know how I missed this because it seems to have been pretty widely reported. Thank you, Tony, for pointing this out. But Atari is going to release a new game called Tempest 4000. So Atari has a history of Tempest games. The original arcade game Tempest was not Atari, it was Williams. But starting with the Atari Jaguar, they released a really cool Tempest game called Tempest 2000 that was famously programmed by Jeff Minter of LlamaSoft fame, who made stuff for the 8-bits back in the day and still makes stuff now. And Jeff Minter's thing is always about trying to make like crazy, mind-blowing, trippy graphics, and Tempest 2000 was really great at that. And he's gone to do other things, a number of things in the decades since. And a couple of years ago, he had a game, it's called, I think it was called TXK or TKX, I forget what it was. And I think it was available for the PlayStation Portable, maybe, and then he was going to release it for PC or something, and he got basically some kind of cease and desist notice from Atari saying, hey, don't release this game anymore on any more platforms because it's too similar to Tempest and we own that IP and we're going to sue you. And so he was not happy about this at all. And of course, this is, you know, Atari is nowadays, it's this weird husk, this weird corpse
zombie
of what Atari ever used to be. Zombie Atari. Sure, they release some software that they mostly have other companies write, but they're mostly just sort of this organization seems to be trying to make money off the old IP, which is, I don't know. I don't want to say it's fine. It's something. But they apparently have come to some sort of peace with Jeff Minter and had him create Tempest 4000. So I haven't seen any screenshots yet or videos. It's probably going to be really cool. Should be out for sometime this year, they say, for PC and consoles. I very much hope that PC includes Mac, but I don't know. Since I don't really have any new consoles, and I don't have... I guess I have a Windows PC that I'd probably run it, but I'd rather have it on my Mac. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's very cool. Hopefully.
Yeah, it is kind of strange, actually, that because I remember it doesn't seem that long ago that there was this huge fight.
Yeah.
So it's weird that they're, you know, joining forces again, but...
Yeah, I guess something... Somebody at Atari must have, like, snapped out of it and realized, hey, we could actually try and, you know, do something good with this guy who has done a lot for Atari back in the day and, continues to do and has done a lot for the gaming industry overall. So,
cool.
Good that they've come to their senses for now.
Ken, you have the next one.
Yeah, let's talk about Alan Turing. This is a news story that was given to us by Carrington, who sadly cannot join us today, so I'll be representing his interests with this story, which is about Alan Turing, who, of course, was the code breaker, who was portrayed by Benedict Cumberbatch in the movie The Imitation Game back in the 1940s. You might say that he helped turn the tide of the war by breaking German codes, and he went on to... in many people's minds, be the father of modern computing. You know, the Turing test is named after him, for example, did a lot of work in development of early computers. Back in the UK, they just found in a drawer at the University of Manchester, I believe, 148 documents by or to Alan Turing that had not been seen for at least 30 years. And so they have now... put all these online, I believe. That's what this article says, although I'm having some trouble finding them in this online index. But they are mostly not about computers. These are declassified since they are immediately online. And it's mostly just correspondence between him and certain individuals. For example, at one point he was invited to give a lecture in the United States, and he wrote back and said, "I detest America." So, great.
Which made the headline. In the whole article.
I've read several articles on this topic, and they all prominently feature Alan Turing's detestation of the United States of America. I hope there's more valuable stuff to be found in here, but I think it's fascinating not only that this was found, which is wonderful, of course, but that this sort of thing seems to happen a lot. It's not like these are archaeologists finding stuff in caves or deserts or in tombs. This is stuff that was put in a filing cabinet. And somebody forgot about it, and it's being unearthed. And I can't help but wonder if this is an artifact, no pun intended, of the way that we catalog things offline, and that it's harder to lose things when you put them online, when you have proper metadata and easier ways to search, reference, and cross-reference your information. Like, now that this stuff has been scanned and put online, will we ever lose it again? Or will 30 years from now somebody say, "Hey, I was searching through this old online index, and I found 148 papers by Alan Turing that nobody has downloaded in 30 years.
Right.
So I wonder how things become lost when they were not all that long ago found. I think that's interesting.
I think there's things that people don't consider to be valuable, and they just put it in a drawer somewhere because they don't want to throw it away and don't bother telling anybody that they put it in a drawer. And then later on, where there is an interest, somebody says, "Hey, I found." So if there is a falling away of interest in things having to do with computer history and Alan Turing in particular, and then later on that interest rises again, they may do that a discovery that you mentioned.
Yeah, I guess it's probably true that if this happened to have been in a period of time when people didn't think of Alan Turing in a particularly big way, then this might just be some folder that has a bunch of old letters that don't mean anything. I'll throw them away. You know, the name has to be relevant to you.
Right, which is why Jason Scott always says about the Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine that it is not our place to determine what future historians will find important, which is why we save everything now.
Exactly. Like,
you know, when GeoCities was being dismantled by Yahoo, some people honestly asked, "Why bother saving GeoCities? It looks like trash, and I don't want people reading the diary I kept when I was 15 years old." But you don't know who you might become. That your 15-year-old diary might be extremely invaluable. I mean, this is, you know, sort of the extreme example, but the Diary of Anne Frank was just a little girl's diary, and yes. Look what became of it.
Yes.
You know, she didn't write that to become famous, and nobody knew that that would happen.
Mm. I think I was looking around a little bit trying to get a hold of these documents, and I think it may be that only the index is online, and you need to actually request it directly of University of Manchester if you want to actually get the copy of the thing, which is a little disappointing. But there are some photos that you can see, but not a lot of them.
That does seem to be my experience, that you can only request it, which is disappointing because the article that we'll link to in the show notes says that they are now online.
Yeah.
And that seems to imply that the articles themselves are not metadata about them.
And it's possible that I've just missed it, and so have you, I guess. But yeah, because it does say now publish the entire archive online for readers to peruse, but all I was able to peruse was the metadata.
Yeah, ditto.
All right, let's see. So I guess next up is me. The thing I will talk about is a deep dive on Zork and carrying too many things. So this was actually, this is a kind of a weird thing that just a few days ago started going around the Twitter sphere. What started it was looking at source code to Zork and observing that there's a conditional in there that says, you know, if weight is less than random 100, do something and say you're holding too many things. And
oh, no, really?
Yeah. And so this was a bit shocking because what it meant was that, in fact, when you try to pick something up in Zork and it says you can't, you're holding too many things, it is possible that if you just do it again, it'll work because it's sort of random whether you're able to pick it up or not. And nobody knew this until now. And so this caused much angst because, you know, and so there's a really interesting thread that's kind of going through it and trying to figure out, looking at the history of Zork and how this all played out. One aspect of this was that Zork itself, when it was originally written, was a big game, and it was split into Zork 1, 2, and 3 when it went into the micros. So it's possible that this was not in Zork 1, but in something later, and Jason Scott had proposed that maybe this had something to do with a fumble spell that you can have cast on you, and so there's that would make some sense of the randomness. But it was tested in Zork 1, and it did, in fact, work. You could say, there's a transcript here of somebody saying, get sword, and it says, you're holding too many things already. And then, get sword, taken. So.
Andrew Plotkin did a more thorough analysis of this code, and it turns out that there are actually two variables that come into play in determining whether or not you can pick something up. How many items you are currently holding, and the total combined weight of your items. If you have fewer than 8 items, you can always pick up one more. I think 8 or more, it becomes random and diminishing chances that you'll be able to pick it up, but still random. Whereas I think if your total weight exceeds 80 pounds, then it doesn't matter how many items you're carrying, you can't pick up anything more.
It's intricate. It's sort of complicated. It isn't purely random. It counts weight, and it counts weight recursively. So things that are heavy inside other things count. Although there was some bug I remember coming across somebody mentioning where, I forget exactly what it was, but you could sort of put things into a container and then you do something like lock it or something, which converts it to a different object underlyingly, which means that you can then pick it up when it's full of heavy things because it's not heavy anymore because it's a different object than the one that holds all the heavy stuff.
Of course, seeing this code makes me think of the picture on the cover of the old personal software release of Zork 1. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's got a guy who's he literally has got an armful of stuff, that including swords and lamps and gems and things. And I can see that if with that going on, it's like you don't really have many hands left to pick up another item. You probably would fumble and drop something.
Yeah. There's a picture of that, the personal software Zork cover on the second link. So there's another link that I wanted to put in here, MIT Technology Review, which is kind of like it's almost like it's both kind of an industry and alumni magazine, had an article on the enduring legacy of Zork, maybe partway down There's a picture of the personal software Zork, which is quite an amazing
yes, that's the one.
Rendition.
Actually, he's carrying as many things as I had pictured in my memory when I mentioned that, but still he's carrying a few things and then trying to wield the sword. That's got to be a little tough.
Yeah. But so this this kind of dive through the Zork source code is actually really super interesting. So it's definitely worth taking a look at that, and just sort of the idea that you could discover now that actually there was another way around the adventure game. And so I had a couple of other links that I wanted to put on here as well. So one of them is the Technology Review article I just mentioned, The Enduring Legacy of Zork. It's sort of, you know, that is taking kind of an MIT-centric view of it. But of course, Zork was written by people at MIT and you know, they founded Infocom. And then the last link that I wanted to put in here was a link to the Computer History Wiki at gunkies.org, where there's a thing about the Zork source code, and it's really quite elaborate as it goes through kind of like the different platforms that it was on and how it got to different places. But part of what I wanted to point this out for is I've never seen this wiki before. This is really interesting. Is this familiar to anyone of you?
No, I have not heard of this one, no. I can't find other entries on there except the Zork one.
Well, I went to the front page. It looks like it's a project that's not super new. You know, it's like maybe 2007, it's like the last 10 years or something. It's the Computer History Wiki. The idea is supposed to be a place to collect together information on old systems. They've currently got 970 articles. You can go under systems, and it looks like actually kind of a nice place to start accumulating information, but I really just have never come across this before.
Yeah, now that I have found an index, it does look like it's a little heavy on my interest is Apple, of course. There's very light on Apple, heavy on other things, and that's fine. You got to have a place for everybody else's stuff. But
yeah, lots of stuff about PDPs and Vaxen. But yeah, so when you're done reading about Zork, you might want to poke around that wiki as well. Okay, let's see. So Steve, you have the next thing.
Well, I read about this on one of my news feeds also, and when you have large organizations like YouTube, like Google, like Apple, Microsoft, whatever, I know that they have their rules about what they're going to do and what they're going to allow, and I never quite understand how sometimes a decision is made that suddenly gets enforced. But YouTube, apparently, there was some channel on YouTube called Every Apple Video, I think is what it was called, and somebody, whether Apple sent a cease and desist letter or what, I don't know, but somebody sent a letter to Google/YouTube that said, take it down. And so they removed all these videos, like Apple commercials and keynotes and launch things and things that it's like, that's history that really should be kept. And a 15-year-old whose name is Sam Henry had been paying attention to this. He'd been archiving these videos, 810 things. And when he found out that it was going to be taken down, he uploaded his own archive. And it's on archive.org and I think someplace else where you can see all these things. And there's a couple commercials on there about Apple II stuff I had not seen before. There's just a lot of things that's like, no, this shouldn't be. In my mind, this shouldn't be taken off. YouTube is the perfect place for it, but YouTube has their rules, and Internet Archive, thankfully, has got more reasonable rules, and they hang on to these things, as we all know. So there's a nice archive. They're called the Unofficial Apple Archive at archive.org, and it's got all these commercials from the Macintosh days, from Steve Jobs interviews, from commercials done by various stars about Apple products over the years. It's interesting all the things that they've saved here, and this is the history of what we've been doing with Apple over the last 40 years that's up here now.
I know, I definitely made, you know, I a lot of links landed in the Every Apple video channel before. I mean, like I remember seeing that and thinking, oh, I really need to, you know, devote a couple of days to just like watching all these things at some point. And I never did. And it's sort of shocking that it disappeared. I mean, I think I was always a little nervous about it, looking at that and wondering if this would ever get taken down, but never enough to actually try to archive it myself. I'm really glad someone did.
And if you look on YouTube, there are other places that you can, like, there's, for example, there's a video on YouTube that will let me look at every Apple Get a Mac advertisement that they had. So unless we'll start seeing these other things get pulled down in the near future, there may have been something else on the channel that caused it to get taken down. But if that's the case, why take down the whole channel? Why not just take off those videos and let the rest of it run?
Yeah. Well, I'm very happy it's saved.
Yes, there's interviews with Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and the company people who ran the company. It's just a good historic source.
Yeah, I'm very happy this got saved too, and I think the fact that this happened the way that it did just kind of continues to show how confused our copyright system is. I mean, the ultimate goal of the copyright and patent system is to enrich the public good. Some people misunderstand that. They think the goal of copyright is to make people rich, but that's not the case. The whole reason why we spend money on time on copyright law is for the general interest, for the public good. And I think it could definitely be argued that when you're pulling down history, this is to the detriment of the public good, not to the enrichment of the public good. It's such a twisted interpretation of what copyright is for. And so in those situations, I just got to shake my head and wonder, don't you guys get this? I mean, sometimes companies think, if I don't protect all of my IP like a foaming at the mouth rabid dog, then I'm sending a signal that it's okay to pirate my stuff. But no, I think a more nuanced approach is probably appropriate.
And frankly, when it comes to a company like Apple, which at least historically has stated openly, we don't really care about the past that much. That somebody else keeping track of all this stuff, if Apple's not going to, it seems like an appropriate thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that's weirdest about this is that it's not like they're asking for it to become unavailable so they, you know, Apple themselves can make it available or something. The effect of this is generally to make it impossible for anyone to see, which doesn't seem like the right move. I can sort of see if it's, you know, somehow someone profiting off of something that they would have otherwise profited on, but yeah. Oh well. Anyway,
at least we have it now.
Yeah. And if you see other similar channels, it might not be a bad idea to archive things you think might need saving. Okay, let's see. I'll jump to Earl next. So, Earl, you have an adventure to relate.
Well, speaking of archiving, our favorite retro computer enthusiast in New Zealand. Well, I don't know. There might be other retro computer enthusiasts in New Zealand. I don't want to impugn any of them. So let me rephrase. One of our favorite retro computing enthusiasts in New Zealand, Teza, had an adventure with an 8-inch floppy disk drive. Some people have never even seen these things. They're crazy huge. 8-inch floppy media was 70s and kind of a holdout in the 80s, but there's still some things on 8-inch media out there that needs to get archived. And Teza had a colleague of his loan him an 8-inch drive, kind of on a long-term loan. And then you got to think several things. Now I have an 8-inch floppy drive. What am I going to hook it to? Turns out he did have a machine that had the right kind of floppy disk controller. I think it was a 386 of some sort, that would permit the connection at a logical level. But then you think, okay, now I got to physically connect it and I have to power the drive. And what kind of crazy power does it need? And it did need a little bit of specialty support there. but he bought a device that let him do it, got it all hooked up, and it works. And then he has a machine, or maybe more than one machine, there's certainly one machine that for which he had some software that there might not have been an archive for anywhere. So he used this contraption that he put together to archive some of this stuff. And it's just, you know, like all of Tez's blog entries, it's a unique and enjoyable walk through how he solves the problem, and great pictures. I think a real enjoyable article. We'll have a link up in the show notes. And one of the other interesting things, this 8-inch drive was toward the end of the line, really, for 8-inch floppy drives. And so, therefore, it had a little bit better technology, and it's a little bit more likely that it will stay up and running for a longer period of time, as opposed to maybe something that was mid-70s or whatever that might be on its last leg.
Yeah, this is super interesting. It's something I would like to try to do. I have a machine that doesn't start that has, you know, a couple of these big 8-inch drives on it, and I have a couple of disks, and I don't know what's on them, and they're not even for that machine.
Is it a TRS-80?
Oh, no, it is it's a Jupiter 2.
Oh, wow.
Kind of a crazy machine, I think we might have talked about it back when I got it, all the boards inside are like wire wrapped. it's a weird thing, which I have been meaning to play with for probably like 3 years or something since I got it. But anyway, it sits atop a couple of big 8-inch drives, which I've never tried to power up. I will read this Tez's account here carefully when I do. Okay, let's see. Just a couple of notes on upcoming shows. VCF Midwest 12 is coming up very, very soon, September 9th to 10th. And Jack's Retro Gathering in what is this? Vosteros? Say it.
It's pronounced Vesteros. Surprisingly similar to Game of Thrones, Westeros.
Yes, okay.
But not related.
So that's coming up September 30th. Tandy Assembly is still coming up early October, October 7th to 8th, somewhere in Ohio. And at the end of October, Portland Retro Gaming Expo, which I'm sure Earl will tell us about if he goes.
Indeed. So,
and distant future, VCF Pacific Northwest in the in 2018, February 10th to 11th.
Oh, I'm so excited for that one.
Yep, that's very cool. Okay, anyway, so now we will move to a word from our sponsor.
40 years ago, the computer age began. Since then, the industry has changed dramatically, and Digital Equipment Corporation has led the way, bringing new products to market, meeting people's changing needs. Now, Digital takes the next step with its new generation of VAX computers. Strong, powerful, more efficient. Technical excellence teamed with human innovation. Digital Equipment Corporation. Then, now, and for years to come, the mark of leadership.
And we're back. So, I'm responsible for the host's retro computing gift idea, and I have a slightly weird one, what I'm suggesting here is building the PAPIC paper computer, which was published in what it looks like the IRE Transactions on Electronic Computers in September 1958. So, but I thought this was kind of cool. So there's a couple of layout descriptions of how you do this. If you print this out, you can cut out the switches and the buses and controls. It's a little bit like what is that called? I've forgotten the name of it, but the mechanical computer that can count, when you drop a marble down it, it's a very physical thing, and as you would expect from 1958. But it has storage registers, an adder, a control switch, and a counter, and so it looks like it would be kind of a fun thing to make, and you can actually just make it for yourself. You don't need to give it to anyone else. But has any of you looked at this before? Just a second.
I can't say I understand it.
I suspect that probably the logic of it, like, it'll take a little bit of a hurdle to understand exactly how it does its adding, and then ultimately it's probably quite simple.
I remember seeing ads in the day in the backs of some magazines for something that called itself a computer. This is, you know, pre-1974 or something like that, that had lots of switches, and not electronic switches, but levers and things that would let you apparently count up things with it. I suspect this is of the same style as that.
Yeah. I wish I'm super frustrated, actually, that I can't remember the name of this machine. And, oh, you know, actually, I know where I can find it. It was a gift idea, I bet. Here it is. Digicomp 2. That's it. I will put a link in the show notes so you can all ooh and ah while I talk about the next thing.
Paper one probably would be easier to do than the building the marble one.
Yeah. But, well, the Digicomp 2 you can actually buy pre-assembled. The paper one, I just thought that was pretty cool, that you could just build this yourself.
Yeah, it looks kind of fun. I want to say that I was scanning through the document here describing this thing, and it talks about another device that is the Samson Additive Digital Sequential Automatic Computer, whose acronym is SADSAC.
Yes. Yes, I think that's pretty cool.
They talk about the SADSAC 2 and the SADSAC 3.
Yeah, apparently the SADSAC 3 was may never have happened.
Yes.
But yeah, actually, I did want to mention something about that too, because so this I don't know this journal. I mean, I don't remember 1958, not having been here during 1958, but just before this discussion of how to build the PEPAC, you know, paper adder thing, there is a mention of the SADSAC 2, which was designed by Peter Samson. It won first place in the Massachusetts State Science Fair and fourth place in the 1958 National Science Fair. Peter, was about to enter MIT in that year. And it turns out that he's actually, like, you know, went on to become kind of a celebrity. So he was interviewed in Stephen Levy's Hacker's book, and he wrote the first editions of the Tech Model Railroad Club, like Hacker Dictionary. He's the one who laid out the stars in Space War. So that's pretty cool. We could sort of see the beginning of his career as he wins science fairs and heads off to MIT to like, you know, do computers. That's it. Are any of you going to build this? No one's going to build this.
Not for me, I think.
Yeah. If anyone does build it, take a photo and, you know, email it to us and we'll tweet it out. Okay. Anyway, so I guess there's not much to buy in that case except for, like, a piece of paper and, you know, locate your scissors. But I think it does require a little bit of glue. But we can all that money we saved from the gift idea, we can spend on eBay. And Earl, you have the first one.
Well, okay. So now this thing's going sideways. So the item that I have on eBay is sideways for IBM PC AT XT N compatibles, just in case you were concerned. This is vintage software and the disks. And the reason that I like this, I love a lot of these old DOS days productivity or utility type applications, especially if they were clever. And I think Sideways was really clever. What it would let you do is print out to a print file, like an ASCII text file, and then Sideways could take that file, and as the name implies, on your dot matrix printer, it could print it sideways. And you might think, what's the advantage of this? Well, these are the days of form feed continuous paper, right? So let's say that you have something that is only 30 lines, but it is 300 columns wide. You could print such a thing with sideways, and it does all the math and all the conversion to the dot matrix so that it can print your text sideways. Your dot matrix printer would have to have graphics capabilities, of course, for this to work, and it supported a few different printers in that. But imagine that you have a big, wide spreadsheet, and you want to print it out. you print it to an ASCII file instead of printing it to the printer, and then you run your ASCII file through sideways, and out comes your output, all glorious 300 columns wide, and also could be useful for programmers. I remember thinking back in the day when this was out, if you had source code that was more than 80 columns and you didn't want to go into condensed, teeny tiny, squishy 132 column print, you could use sideways to print out some of your listings and see them in their full glory. And this is $20, so I thought it was a good deal, and it interested me because I love some of these things. The nearly similarly named but totally different utility Sidekick was also a cool one back in the DOS days, and just things like that. So that's my entry. It's cheap. You can buy it. Like Paul says, you can take the money you save from the not having to buy a gift, because, you know, paper and glue, everybody's got that on hand.
Yeah, sideways is pretty cool. Actually, the packaging is fairly attractive. This did exist for, I have a couple of versions of this for the Apple II as well. So,
Okay.
Sidekick was like a terminate and stay resident menu system, right? Something like that?
Yeah, a little note taker, basically a little personal information manager, very tiny, of course. And like you say, it would hook in and kind of stay live in RAM, and you could hit a hotkey and bring it up.
Cool. So don't buy that. Buy sideways. But Sidekick is kind of cool to remember.
Oh, buy either one. They're both kind of fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think I ever used Sidekick. I was aware of it, but it was never sort of part of my PC workflow. Oh, well. That's not an interesting fact. Sorry. Ken, save us. Tell us about Atari games.
Yeah, Atari games. So I have been on a quest to get the gang back together. When I was a kid, I had about 43 games for the Atari 2600. And when we got the 8-bit Nintendo, when I was about 9 years old, my dad said, well, you don't need the Atari anymore, and he got rid of the whole collection. Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why, to this day, I never throw anything out, because I learned by a counterexample from my dad.
Right.
But even back then, though, even at 9 years old, I was really into, like, cataloging and indexing stuff, and I had a Apple Writer file on my computer on a 5 1/4-inch floppy disk that listed every game we owned. So now I have an Atari 2600, and I'm trying to get all the games I had as a kid. Now, I have about 100 games now for the Atari 2600, but I still don't have all 43 that I had as a kid. So I went on eBay to find a few after having gotten 13 more games that I was looking for as a kid at Kansas Fest, actually, from Ian Baranofsky. Nice. On Twitter as Delicious Games. And so I'm still missing just like 6 more. So I went on eBay and I found a format of auction that I was not familiar with. It's basically one lot and it has a drop down that lists all the games in the lot, and you just choose which ones you want. They're not separate auctions for different games. It's a buy it now and you choose which ones you want. And if you choose 3 at checkout, it automatically deducts the price of the cheapest one. So it's buy 2, get 3 free, which is how this seller has set up his auction. And so he had 3 of the games I was looking for, and I was able to get all 3 and only for the price of 2. And I thought that was really neat. I had never seen that on eBay before.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm actually really impressed that you remember all 43 games.
Yes.
Well, that's what the document's for, right?
Right, I have the list on my computer of what games I own. I don't know that I necessarily remember playing them or even that I have fond memories. Like, one of the games that I still don't own, for example, that I had as a kid was 3D Tic-Tac-Toe. I have no fond memories of that because I was a kid, and I'm like, how the hell do you play Tic-Tac-Toe in 3D? I was just like, what happens if I put this here? What happens if I put that there? I don't understand this game. I'm going to play Freeway or Superman or Journey Escape.
The only winning move is not to play.
Exactly. So those were the 3 games I just bought on eBay. Superman, Freeway, and Journey Escape. And I still need to get Real Sports Baseball and 3D Tic-Tac-Toe. I also just bought Krull online. So that's 4 of the 6 games I was missing. So just 2 more, and then I'll have the complete set.
Cool.
Yeah, but this nice. eBay auction, the format and the price just made it really easy for me to grab a whole bunch of games all at once.
I've seen this kind of auction a couple times before, but it's not. But it is pretty rare. I don't know why. Like maybe it's just different kinds of like different sort of segments of eBay's just have different norms or something. Because I've never seen this in like in anything except something like this, where it's just a bunch of cartridges and you're just trying to pick one. And I have seen it a couple times in that kind of auction.
It looks like this one seller has about 8 of these, looks like, set up.
Oh, really?
8 different lots with a bunch of games in each lot.
Oh, I wonder if some of the other lots had games I was missing and didn't even notice.
Yeah, you should take a look. I think the one that you linked is the only lot that has manuals for all the games. The others seem to be just cartridges.
Yes, that is true. The games come with manuals, no boxes, though.
Yep.
I see that there's a couple that jump out at me. Word Zapper, Space Jockey, Sneak and Peek, possibly Commando Raid. That all have the Mater Tectura font on them, which is the one that Apple wrote Apple Computer Inc. and Apple II on, initially for a while, and also Trapper
right.
Keeper and what was it, some sort of sneaker
Reebok, I think.
Yeah, but the font of the 80s. Cool. Let's see, where are my show notes? Steve, why don't you go next?
Okay. Well, I was just looking to find something interesting, and I have never owned an Apple II clone. I don't really plan on trying to get a collection of them, other than pictures of things. But somebody on eBay is selling a clone that was made, I believe, in Taiwan. The Unitron company from Taiwan made an Apple II clone. It's kind of a 2E plus clone, or 2E plus. That doesn't make sense on here. Probably a 2 plus is what it is, clone. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting as you look at there's actually the guy who put this up there, he's listing it for $195 and has shipping that's probably appropriate for the weight. Talks about what it does and doesn't do. And he did have a link to a page that talks about the Unitron on epilogic.org. Just kind of tells all about it and has the company that did it did as best to make everything not only work like the Apple II, but look like the Apple II, although it had a blue motherboard instead of a green one. But a disk controller card has a little up arrow for disk one and down arrow for disk two, just like on the one that you'd expect from Apple. So
mm-hmm. It's a perfect clone, except for it's blue.
Right. Exactly. So it's just interesting that this is out there, and if you wanted to add this to your Apple clone collection, this would be perhaps a good choice. From 1981 or so, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks kind of cool. I can't quite bring myself to get into the clone collections, but some people do. And there were, for a long time, I think, quite a lot of Apple II clones running around.
I wish I could get a Franklin. One of the stores that I worked at wasn't an Apple dealer. It's a beautiful storefront, but Apple was they had interesting policies about their dealerships, like geographic limitations and that kind of thing. So instead, we decided to try to make a go with the Franklins. I think, if my fading memory serves, that was around the time Franklin got the big old smackdown from Apple. And so that option kind of evaporated. But I really did like the machine. I thought it was nicely built. If ever I stumble upon one of those, I might have to grab it.
I think there was one at the garage giveaway this year at Kansas Fest.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, it's true. No, I think there were a couple, yeah. Franklin made a couple of different models. I had a friend in high school who had one, so I feel sort of like nostalgia in law for it. But cool. And you had another Apple II related one too.
Well, yes, there's the most valuable Apple IIs that are out there these days are the ones that are the original Apple II, not the 2 Plus, and of course low serial number makes them more valuable. There is somebody here who is selling an Apple II not so early that it still that it lacked the vents. It has the vents on the side. But this is serial number 1144. And it's a steal because the original price was $18,500 and now it's only $14,800. So there's a $3,700 savings, 20% off by order buying it now. Yeah. It does look like it's pretty, like it's in good condition, and it's got lots of software, cassettes and discs both for it, and so it's probably a good deal, but not something that again I'm going to try to invest in, I think.
All right, I bought it.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, this has been listed sort of off and on for a while, and it frequently gets posted on the Facebook group, people marveling at the price. It is a nice specimen, and it's early enough that they, you know, it was sort of before the serial, it was when the serial numbers were still represented on the motherboard and stuff, so it really is, you know, within the first 1500 made.
And it has a toggle switch on the back instead of a rocker switch, mm-hmm. and just a few things that were evidence of the early models. The white 6502 chip on the motherboard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that I wanted to mention too is that this is the seller is the same guy who makes the Newton Apple I replicas. So I basically trust this guy to know his stuff, you know, and the stuff is cool. It is it's many thousands. But it is a nice specimen. All right, I'll see if I can compress my auctions a little bit here, but I have a few that I would mention. The first one I will talk about is a vintage K-Pro 2000, very rare laptop, no keyboard or power supply, good condition. So I may have a search on for K-Pro, but at least I the word K-Pro catches my attention. So I saw this listing for a K-Pro that I'd never heard of before, the K-Pro 2000. And it's actually a pretty cool looking thing. So it's a little bit, kind of looks like a turtle. it's kind of like a laptop form factor, but it's an early one. And it was released in 1985. It flips up. It has a LCD screen, monochrome LCD screen. The first version of it had a fairly narrow one. I think it was still 80 by 25, but very, very short characters. And it had a keyboard, a removable keyboard that sort of comes out a little bit like the compacts. And this was, I think, MS-DOS computer. But I had never seen one before. I thought this was kind of cool. The actual auction makes me sad. So if you read through the auction text, basically what we have here is a K-Pro 2000 that is missing the keyboard because somebody in a previous listing of this auction bought just the keyboard. So it is now relisted. And the power supply is separate, although there's another auction by this seller that has it's not exactly a power supply, but it's an external battery pack. And also all the manuals are in yet another auction. So I was pleased to be able to see this K-Pro 2000. I was a little less enthusiastic about the way in which it is being sold. But are any of you familiar with this thing? It was totally new to me.
I can't say if I've come across this one before.
I haven't either.
So now a new thing to want. Just what I needed. At least it's small. But I sort of assumed the K-Pro just vanished along with CPM, but apparently they did make a little bit of a go at it. The next thing I will quickly mention is there is a listing for an IMSI 8080, so the War Games machine, that comes along with a desk that has three 8-inch floppy drives mounted inside of it and a case that holds a hard drive, and it looks really nice. Crammed full of cards. You have to pick it up by going to Ohio, and it is $8,000, but that might almost be not crazy for this.
And it looks like it's such very good shape. Clean, yes.
And I actually kind of love the disk drives in the desk.
Would those be desk drives then?
I guess they would. yes. Okay. Anyway, so take a look at that. The next one I wanted to point out is, I thought this was pretty cool. This is a handheld paper punch, like paper tape puncher. So if you thought typing into a punch card or paper tape punch was just too newfangled, and you missed the days of the toggling of the switches, then you can punch your own paper tape one character at a time by rotating a little wheel and hitting punch.
Oh my goodness, that would be so sad.
You know, I could see this being useful once or twice for some people. Like if you had a paper tape reader, but not a paper tape punch, and you wanted to load a small bootstrap program.
Yeah, at some point
like
in the retropocalypse, this will be needed.
This is true.
Yeah,
indeed.
It's, yeah, it's
yeah, the power's out. We still have to enter these numbers. Get going.
Right. Anyway, but yeah, that's true. No electricity required for the punching of the tape. If you, you know, if you're trying to leave a record to those who come after. So the next one, there's a set of auctions here. Is it still at zero bids? Yeah. I am almost hesitant to even bring this up just because. Because
you want them?
Yeah. Well, actually, no, I have one of these, so I can leave this one. But so there's an auction for the thing that caught my attention was these two Epson PF10s, which are 3.5-inch floppy disks that go with the Epson PX8. And these things are, as far as I understand it, super, super rare. Like
they're
you can
pretty,
never...
they're pretty unobtainium.
Yeah. Here are two of them. The starting bid is $15. This is not somebody who's capitalizing on the fact that they are super rare. They probably just don't know. They have a bunch of Epson PX8 stuff as well. So there's these things, but there's also a pair of printers, P80s. And the PX8 itself, and these are all separate auctions. And you know the two printers are going for starting bid of $15. Oh, you know, actually, it's possible. That's weird. The PX8, you heard it here first. No one's going to see it because it's listed in categories collectibles, advertising, computers, and high tech. So you will. You listeners of RCR will have an advantage over everyone else because no one's going to see this unless they did what I did, which is see the PF10s and look at the other auctions. But and then the last one is it's PX8 software, and I thought this was actually pretty cool. I can't guarantee I'm not going to bid on this, but so it's got a couple of the ROM packs, so Portable WordStar, Portable Calc, that normally come with these. But it also has BASIC, and I'm pretty sure that BASIC is a fairly rare ROM pack to get.
Oh, I think it actually came with, didn't it? I could swear that the BASIC ROM pack came with the PX8.
Oh, okay.
Along with the CPM utility ROM pack. Don't quote me on that. It's been 30-some years, but I thought that was the case.
Well, if that is the case, then I won't bid.
Well, the PF10s are an amazing find.
Yeah, that is that's crazy.
And, you know, with some of the Epson, the PX8 itself, but also some of the peripherals, if the battery pack has gone to heaven, then the peripheral can't really operate even if you plug it in. It's like, you know, the way that they cycle the power through. So you got to replace the battery pack. And then once you do, oftentimes the device will spring to life. So they say these PF10s are sold as is. And it's possible you'd have to spend $20, $30, $40 to rejuvenate, you know, get a new battery pack with the right form factor in that. But I bet they do work.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, the seller did a really nice thing, which is open the back where the battery pack is. These, if I'm not mistaken, these actually have another little battery inside that needs addressing, but this big battery pack is not, in both of them, has not, you know, turned to mush. So if you get them soon, it should be okay. And actually, also, the printers have batteries in them, too. So that will need addressing. The seller did not show pictures of those, but I remember taking batteries out. I've taken batteries out of all of these things, and I have not done anything more than that. But at least I did the first step. Anyway, yeah, it's very cool stuff. So take a look at that. And I will, the last auction that I'm going to mention is there is about to be another Apple One auction. It's supposed to start September 12th. I don't think we've mentioned it. It is David Larson's Apple One. He is the second owner of it. It was purchased from Adam Skolsky, I suppose, for $3,500 in 1994. There's a letter as part of the auction that sort of has that agreement. So I am guessing that it's going to go for more than $3,500 in this auction next week. But I have looked, you know, I've seen various Apple One auctions before, and this is really quite something. It's a working Apple One. It's got a lot of stuff that comes with it. The original box that Woz has signed. In fact, I'm not even sure he signed it. I don't think this is a post fame signature. I think this was just him writing on the box initially before they sold it. It has all kinds of documentation. This was the existence of this machine was mentioned in Bob Luther's The First Apple book, and so that's also included, as well as some Ron Wayne signed illustration that. Anyway, just take a look at what's included. It's I suspect this is the best Apple One auction there has ever been. So I don't know what, you know, I don't know what it's. I don't have a guess as to what it will get, but it's something.
Yeah, it looks like a pretty one that they've made here. He's got he doesn't have it all in a case. It's kind of you see the parts. Yeah, that's a good one.
So I will be interested to see what it goes for. It. The prices on Apple Ones at auction has peaked and declined a bit since I forget exactly what it went for. I think the one that went for the most was like 800,000 or something like that. It was some very large amount.
Yeah, it was close to a million. Yes.
Yeah. So, all right. So, you know, if you saved a lot from the gift idea and building that little paper thing, you'll be all set. Okay. Anyway, so I'll leave my auctions there, which I think also means that we have reached the wrap up point, and we can go into closing discussions. So, Earl, any closing shots?
Oh, just on a personal note, my house is a little lighter and probably a little sadder at this point as my daughter has gone on to university. She's moved out. She's in the dormitory now and is just finished up her first week of university. It sounds like she's having a lot of fun and has a lot of homework and and things are good. Luckily, she's only about a half hour from here on the road. So it's not like she relocated to another place in the country or whatever. So it's closer to home. That's good. But she's off on her own. That's also good. She can concentrate on her studies and focus.
Has she picked a major to go into?
She's going into marketing, actually. Mm-hmm. She's going to be a business major.
Now, she's the person with whom you did some projects, electronics projects together that you mentioned on your podcast in the past, haven't you? Isn't she?
She is.
Yes.
We did that many years ago. We actually, around a propeller microcontroller chip, we built a computer together.
Yes.
And took it to a couple of the local club meetings and ran BASIC on it. And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Nice.
Good memories, Steve.
Well, good luck to her.
Yes.
On that.
Yeah, thank you.
It's hard to remember that time, but it was a lot of fun that ran out that initial just being dropped into college. Yes. Well, Jack, how about you?
Nothing too much. I've just got a cold and I'm pretty quiet this episode, but no.
Okay. Ken, how's your summer wrapping up? What's in your future?
Not too much. I have a lot of game conventions coming up. I have the Boston Festival of Indie Games coming up at MIT in a few weeks. Then I'm traveling to Gamer X East in New York City in November, and then PAX South in January, and then PAX East in Boston in April, which they just announced for the first time ever will be 4 days instead of three. I honestly don't know how I'm going to survive all that. So I'm just enjoying this lull before the storm.
Wow.
That seems like not an unpleasant storm, though.
This is true. It's not like the kind of conferences that my workplace would send me to. I might be going to Texas for a healthcare internet conference. Yay. I'm sorry, Steve. That is probably really insulting to you.
No. It's humorous to me because they've been trying to come up with some way of doing healthcare stuff with computers for years, and I think it's more of a we should find a way to use this technology for people kind of a thing than something that's ever actually practical. Because I hear this happen all the time, and it's probably the closest thing you'd have to it would be apps on a mobile device, a tablet or a phone, and that didn't even come out of necessarily any medical company's ideas. It probably came on the fact that here's this technology everybody actually has in their hands now. Let's make use of it. But nothing has ever worked.
We need to find a problem.
Yeah, sometimes it's that. And nothing's really ever worked out in the past that has been that useful for these things. So I won't be holding my breath to find something useful coming out of your meeting. But if it does, I'll be ready for it.
Excellent. Yeah, well, for me, summer is ending much, much too quickly. For me, school has not begun, but it's about to. So sort of mad dash to finish off all the stuff that I meant to do over the summer and prepare for all the stuff that's about to happen when the school year starts. So, and my office is still a disaster.
No, Paul, I really am thinking one of these days it would be nice to actually have some photos.
Yeah, I keep thinking that would be kind of cool too, except that it's embarrassing at the moment.
Well, but it's no more embarrassing than any of the students that you happen to have come in there, you know, so any,
that's true.
You know,
right,
they get to see it. I think the rest of us should get to see what all you've got squirreled in there too.
That's right, Paul. This is a safe space, Paul.
Yes, right.
Okay. You're among friends here.
Won't be judging you much.
Right, Steve. You have something to announce.
Well,
even.
A small announcement. I don't post things very frequently on my Apple II History website these days, but things I have posted in the last couple of years have had more to do with Kansas Fest and. One of the things I enjoy doing with my spare time, probably far more than I ought to, is messing around with Minecraft, building things in Minecraft. And I actually had a video some years ago on YouTube, and back in 2011, back when it was in the Minecraft beta days, I made a video showing an Apple II Plus, Apple II, 2 Plus, you couldn't tell from looking at it, made in Minecraft. And I was rather proud of that sad little thing. But I decided to make another one a couple years later that was larger, bigger scale. I had 2 blocks to 1 inch. I made 4 blocks to 1 inch on this next one. And I made an Apple IIe that over the space of probably about 3 or 4 years I worked on and finally finished. And I put out a video. If you search YouTube for Minecraft Apple IIe, you'll see it. And I take a walkthrough through it and show a few pictures of it in process. I had a person who posted a message to me and said, hey, why don't you make this available as a schematic that one could use with MC Edit to paste into a Minecraft world? So I looked and found it would actually be fairly easy to do that, and it wouldn't be a huge, it's a 1.8 meg download. So I have that now on my website. If you play Minecraft and if you know how to use MC Edit, then you can paste this in there and you can go strolling around the Minecraft Apple II if you'd like.
Love Minecraft. Cool. And I probably also spend too much of my discretionary time with Minecraft, but I'm very much looking forward to this. I think I'm going to do it.
Oh, good. Well, tell me what you how well the process works for you, because I know how to export it. And I was able to import it to another world, and I found that it worked, but that's as far as I know. I don't know if anybody's actually downloaded it yet, so you could be the first.
Awesome.
Apple2History.org is the main website, and it's got a link on one of the posts up there that'll mention it. So.
Yep. And if I'm reading it right, it says 4 downloads.
Ooh.
So we're getting there.
I'm hitting the big times.
I can confirm that at least almost all the time that I've seen you, Steve, in person, you've been, you know, in the front row at Kansas Fest playing Minecraft.
Well, it's a great thing to do when I'm listening to something else. I can kind of just play things and build things on there. So,
yeah, very cool. I actually have never quite gotten into it. I have managed to dig myself into a hole a couple times, and that's about it.
Just don't ever dig straight down. That's all.
Yeah. Okay.
Bad things happen.
Yes.
All right. So I guess that's it. Everybody's talked, right? I think so. I think I've gotten to everybody. So I guess we can wrap it up. That'll be it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, where you will get all of Ken's tweets. And you can join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. And send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We love to hear from you. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That'll help other people find the show. And so, until next time...
Retro Compute!